I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about multipassionals, people who balance occupations to assure both greater financial stability and increased variety in their working lives. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of being a multipassional and how common it is to find multipassionals. My guest will be Aaron Albert, an entrepreneur, attorney, pharmacist, and college professor, who also is the author, perhaps not surprisingly, of a book called Multipassionals. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the evolving, continually evolving nature of work and career. The springboard is a new book called Multipassionals, The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio. My guest is Aaron Albert, who's an entrepreneur, writer, pharmacist, attorney, and professor at Butler University. He's also the founder of two companies, Farm LLC and Yespi LLC. Welcome to the program, Aaron. I could list more of your biography, but we actually want to talk about the book a little bit, too.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. I should say to our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, let's start with a definition here. How are we defining multipassional? And I struggled a little bit. Am I pronouncing it the right way?
You are, actually. Okay. That's the fun part about inventing a word. You get to...
You and Shakespeare. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So a multipassional is someone who has multiple careers kind of happening simultaneously. There's been a lot of literature about the idea of slashes, mm-hmm. or individuals who have careers kind of at different segments of time. But the more I keep talking to and observing, you know, the rock stars in my network, the more I started noticing that they were unearthing several jobs at the same time. It's funny, one of the gals that's actually in the book, when I first met her, she pulled out a business card and started talking about her first job. And then the longer the conversation went, she just kept putting out more and more business cards with her name on them, but had several different kind of careers all kind of going on at once.
And how did you arrive at the idea of, I mean, obviously you fit the definition of a multipassional yourself, right?
Yes.
Yes. How did you arrive at the idea of doing the book? I mean, when did you begin to think that there is a book in this?
Well, I'm kind of a trend hunter. I like to notice patterns, and then when I keep noticing them over and over, that's usually good fodder for a book. And, you know, even John, you're a multipassional if you really think about it. And, you know, just as recent...
And here I just thought I was a guy with a short attention span, but that's a whole other...
But, you know, there's negative and positive connotations associated with multipassionalism. I guess the negative connotation is that people are now forced to income patch, if you will, in that, you know, the stable 9-to-5 promise of one employer taking care of all your needs for the next 30 years is kind of going away. It's an antique notion. Coupled with the fact that, you know, just as recent as this weekend, the government put out a report about 40% of the U.S. workforce now is contingency based or not necessarily in a stable day job. And that was up almost 40% from 10 years ago, 5 years ago, when they were putting out the report the last time.
What's driving these changes?
It's so multifactorial. It's everything from the Affordable Care Act, which we talked about a little bit before the show, the fact that, you know, employers are struggling with, you know, do I have to pay health care benefits to employees who I employ under 29 hours a week, all the way through to the internet and working from home and telecommuting to the fact that some people really the new capital is flexibility rather than pay in some instances, in that some people, I'm Generation X and Generation Y, the millennials, they are willing to sacrifice some benefits in order to gain flexibility in their lives.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Erin Albert, who is the author of a new book called Multipassionals, The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. So in terms of ballpark number, I mean, how many multipassionals are out there? I mean, how large a trend is this?
Well, again, going back to the government report, they recently reported, the GAO, around 40.2% of the U.S. workforce is contingency workers. So they're either part-time, they're independent contractors, you know, hustling for their own gigs. They are people on call, kind of working ad hoc. And the trend's only kind of going up. But the flip side and the positive of being multipassional in a lot of the instances that I've seen, at least in the cases in the book, these folks have an overarching theme in their career, and then they kind of use that as the algorithm, if you will, in choosing which part-time or full-time jobs they want to add on to their careers.
Yeah, and I want to follow the government report a bit. So if they're part-time or contingency workers, as you say, they meet one of the definitions, right? One of the criteria for being in that they are not full-time gainfully employed by a single employer.
Well, a multipassional can be full-time employee, but also they have something else.
Things, and add other responsibilities on. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is the folks who are contingency workers aren't necessarily multipassionals. They have to have other occupations as well besides the one that is listed there.
Correct. Yeah, I'm talking about people that have more than one thing going on.
And do we have any documentation on how many of those folks there are? Or is it something that's so new that we really haven't started tracking it yet?
You know, I don't know if we've honestly tracked it. You know, the government always seems to track what the traditional idea of the 9-to-5, you know, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to get a great job with a Fortune 100 company, I'm going to work for them for 30 years, I'm going to, you know, retire and get the gold watch. And we have to get a lot more sophisticated with how we're tracking employment in this mm-hmm. country, because it's so much more complex. It's like relationships on Facebook. It's complicated.
How did you get started? I mean, obviously, you had to go to law school, right? You're a pharmacist as well, college professor, entrepreneur. I mean, what started you on the path that you were on?
That's a great question. I think growing up with, first of all, parents that did not have the privilege of going to college, I was a first-generation college graduate in my family. That had something to do with it. But more than that, my parents also had full-time jobs, and they were part-time entrepreneurs as well. And I think being around that culture of hustling, be it, you know, having a full-time job and then supplementing your income through entrepreneurship, was something that I just grew up around. So it was kind of commonplace for me.
Where did which started for you? I mean, first of all, you say you were first-generation college student. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Butler University, so kind of gone full circle.
So you came back home then. I'm familiar with that dynamic. So you went to Butler. What did you study?
Pharmacy.
Pharmacy. So you started out planning to be a pharmacist then, right?
And I was a pharmacist. I was right out of school. I went to Plymouth, Indiana, and opened up the Kroger Pharmacy in bustling metropolis that is Plymouth.
And that is Plymouth. Okay,
yes.
And how long did you do that?
A couple of years, actually. And then I made some life and career decisions to move to Philadelphia and worked in the pharmaceutical industry out there in several different capacities. My family was still here back in Indiana, so I returned home a couple years later. And from there, continued to work in the industry and started doing some surveys and benchmarking around career development within the pharmaceutical industry. Had all this data, nowhere to publish it. And so I decided that I would start my own consulting company on the side to not only publish this information, but then help coach and develop others into the industry.
And then how did you make the decision to go to law school?
Well, that's it depends on which part of me you're asking, I guess. The pharmacist in me was very, very concerned about the fact that with the Affordable Care Act coming online at the time, a lot of the decisions that are being made about healthcare in this country are being made not by pharmacists or physicians or healthcare professionals. They're actually being made by lawyers. Mm-hmm. So part of, you know, the reason I wanted to go to law school was not to, quote unquote, become a lawyer, but to advocate for healthcare as a healthcare professional who can also speak the lawyer language.
Okay. And where did you do your legal training?
I went to Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law at night while I was teaching during the day at Butler as a pharmacy professor.
Okay. So how did you make the trip back then to Butler from your pharmacy work so that you could become a lawyer? Trying to connect the dots here. And by the way, you look much too young to have done all of this.
Oh, well, thank you. I just had a birthday this weekend, so I definitely need that boost. Industry at the time was undergoing some changes, as it still is, and the industry meaning pharmaceutical industry. And after I started my consulting company and started publishing, I had to make a decision if, you know, I was going to continue in the industry or continue as an entrepreneur. I really had to make that choice. And so academia, as you know, is very supportive of being entrepreneurial. So I had a conversation with my current manager at a scientific meeting, and we just kind of created a win-win situation where I could teach full-time as an academician, but I could also pursue writing, publishing, and entrepreneurship.
And then when did you first notice this trend of the multi-patients? And you said that you're someone who is a trend watcher. I mean, obviously, you had your own experience here where you sort of were layering career on top of career as you went along. When did you begin to think, oh, okay, I'm not an isolated example here, that there are other people out there like me?
Yeah, I think it's through other books that I published. I published a book called Single Women Entrepreneurs, and I found a lot of those women were actually holding down a day job, either part-time or full-time, and starting their entrepreneurial endeavor on the side. To another book that I published called Plan C, where it kind of looked at these hybrid career professionals, those who had a day job and then also wanted to have some kind of entrepreneurial thing on the side and either grow it and then leave the day job and or keep both. So between those two publications, I kept noticing these professionals that had all these things going on simultaneously.
What was the tipping point? I mean, that's the, I guess, a Malcolm Gladwell phrase, but when you began to think, okay, I've talked to, was it the fifth person you'd noticed doing this? And I probably should ask, is it primarily a female phenomenon? You know, and there is some research out there that suggests that many women do better jobs of balancing responsibilities than many men do. That they're socialized that way. There's even some evidence that they may be hardwired that way a little bit.
In this book, I actually feature men and women, kind of a 50-50 split. But back to your point, women entrepreneurs start businesses for very different reasons than men. Mm-hmm. And in my research, I've noticed that women start businesses primarily because they need a life overhaul. It's not just the 9-to-5 job. They're actually working on creating a better life for themselves. And entrepreneurship just offers that flexibility.
So, again, getting to the point, was it, a point where you saw 10, 12 that you began to think? And then how did you go out and find the other folks like you?
It's funny when you have the intent, I guess, and I had seen a couple of cases that once I decided that I was going to study these folks, they just kind of came to me. The universe will bring to you kind of in a woo-woo way what it is that you're looking for. So it wasn't a difficult decision to, once, you know, I decided to write the book, to find others.
How did they find out about you?
They were in my network, and networking is a huge component.
So it's a social media kind of thing? Or is
social
it...
media, and then your own personal and professional networks. And the multi-patients have really diverse networks. So it's really interesting to talk to them because they almost play this little game on seeing the connections between all their jobs and then how the social connections are put together.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the evolving nature of work. We're talking with the author of a new book, Multipatients: The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guest is Aaron Albert, an entrepreneur, writer, pharmacist, attorney, and college professor. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the evolving nature of work and career. Springboard is a new book, Multipatients: The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio, by Aaron Albert, who in addition to being an author is also an entrepreneur, a pharmacist, an attorney, and a college professor. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we've talked about how you sort of identified multipatients. Let's take it, if there's someone out there who is thinking, all right, I've recognized the evolving nature of the workplace and the economy, and I'd really like to sort of fashion a much more balanced work and career portfolio for myself. How should he or she go about doing that?
That's a great question. One of the fundamental things I think a multi-patient needs to step back and before they decide whether or not they're adding or subtracting from their careers is to consider, what do they value? What's important to them? And their values may change over time. For example, we have one multipatient that's in the book that calls himself, the recovering multipatient. And that, now in his career, he has three little ones at home. And, he has multiple things going on, both as an entrepreneur and as an employee. And he had to start pairing off to decide that he really wanted to focus his time and energy on his children rather than, having five different things going on in terms of his career. So I think you have to kind of start with what it is that's really important to you in terms of your, life, not just your job. But think about, is flexibility important to you? Is building social capital important to you? Is building financial capital important to you? And then kind of ranking those out in a list and then going from there based upon what your priorities are.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Amy. If you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at NoLimitsWFYI. Amy writes, Aaron L. Albert and John Kroll, love your show and love Aaron's work in STEM for young women. Can Aaron address how one can balance the need to keep your day job but go back for another degree?
Yeah, I've been lucky to go back to my graduate programs actually part-time while I was working full-time because as a single woman, I never really had the luxury of going back to school full-time. So I think the good news here is that more and more graduate programs are catching on to the fact that people don't have the luxury of leaving their day jobs or, streams of income that they're receiving in order to get further education. So finding a program, for example, when I went to law school, I went to IU Robert H. McKinney School of Law because it was founded as a part-time evening program for people that wanted to go to law school and add that on to their careers, not just, focus on it solely as a full-time student for a couple of years. So with the internet, with MOOCs or these massive open online courses, there are so many great ways to learn and get educated. And, you know, I always tell my pharmacy students as a professor that, you know, you've signed up for a profession that is going to mandate that you continue your education after you leave the hallowed halls of Butler University. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us to get further education. It just depends on, now we have such a variety of ways to learn, what's the best way.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about multipatients. It's people who have different occupations at the same time as a way of sort of balancing their work and life responsibilities. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Roberta, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was wanting to comment, although that there was no such name for it, what you're discussing when I did it, but I'm now a retired person, but I was a nurse. I got a master's degree in psychiatric nursing. And then because I wanted to be able to do research, and research education was not as available in nursing as it is now, I got my PhD in clinical psychology. As a nurse psychologist, many doors opened for me, both in community mental health, as a university professor, kind of a walking multidisciplinary person, getting research grants from the federal government and private foundations, and even engaging in private psychotherapy practice. So we didn't have a name for it, but I've been doing it for over 40 years. And it's really been, offered me a tremendous amount of flexibility and really complementary skills.
What, Roberta, if I might ask while you're on,
sure,
on the phone, what sort of pushed you to do it? Was it sort of dissatisfaction? Was it a restlessness? Was there ambition?
I was quite happy with nursing, and I've always been happy in nursing. I wanted to do more in the way of healthcare research. And at the time, there were only 18 nursing PhD programs. Now there are many, many more. And so I looked at the kind of research I wanted to do and the areas that would complement skills I already had as a psychiatric nurse, and chose clinical psychology. So I've been a licensed clinical psychologist, a nursing professor, and in many other roles in which both identities were equally important.
And you say you're retired now?
Yes, except for a small private practice.
I kind of figured there was going to be an asterisk there with you. Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your story, Roberta.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So this is not necessarily a new thing. I mean, I'm guessing Roberta's a little bit older than you are. And so,
well, she's retired, yes.
Yeah, so is part of it that this has always been, I mean, I'm sure somebody out there is saying, okay, what we're really talking about here is just being an entrepreneur. You know, about expanding your possibilities and all of that and seeing opportunities that other people don't see.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And, you know, props to Roberta, because I think a lot of folks in academia actually end up on that kind of career path where, you know, they're teaching and they figure out there's a new avenue that they want to go down, and they explore that and they go back and further their education, which is phenomenal because they keep adding on these skills to what they previously, or as Roberta said, you know, nursing was her core gig that she kept adding things onto. And I think that's awesome. You know, I think it has been around for a long time, but, you know, as we talked about at the top of the show, the government is noticing that this has become a trend. This is kind of exploding. And so, you know, just like we talk about the nuclear family in this country and how the nuclear family is actually decreasing, so too, I argue, is this notion of the traditional nuclear job, if you will, this 9-to-5, 30-year full-time, you know, one corporation is going to take care of you for your entire career. That notion is too decreasing.
Mm-hmm. And as it has changed, I'm sure the question is out there. I mean, to some degree, does being a multi-patient liberate you or just create further demands on people? I mean, to some degree, and I realize it can be a difference of perspective. Yes, you think, okay, I'm not beholden to one employer. I have many different options. On the other hand, to some degree, you do become a slave to the marketplace, too, and to the demands of many different jobs, and there's really no one to help you balance that but you.
True, but the only person that's really in charge of your own career is you, too. Your boss isn't going to take care of that anymore. Your coworkers aren't going to do that for you. You have to do it for yourself. And so back to the earlier point, you know, this is not a new concept in that, you know, Daniel Pink, his first book, Free Agent Nation, talked about this phenomena that was coming in that back to being, you know, entrepreneurial and doing your own thing. But still, you know, I view entrepreneurship as a spectrum that, you know, on one end, you are the full-time traditional employee and have expectations that your employer is going to do everything for you. And that's one job that you're going to keep forever. On the other end of the spectrum, you are a hardcore, diehard entrepreneur that wants to make all the calls and decisions, and you really don't want to work for anyone but your customer. So I think most of us in this country are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. And so thinking about, you know, how much entrepreneurship you want to get into your career, that's definitely an avenue that multi-patients in most cases took, but not all. Some one of the gals in the book, I joke and call her the multi-patient that has no job left behind because she keeps bringing jobs that she had previously into kind of her current career milieu while adding on other jobs. And she plays this game in that she sees connections between all of these jobs and how, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 for her. It's not that she compartmentalizes each of these jobs. They're all part of her life. And then she plays the game of how are all of these things connected?
Who are the people who succeed at being multi-patient and who are the people who fail?
You know, in terms,
because it is a different kind of mindset.
Yeah. In terms of one of the trends that I found that was fascinating in the book, and myself included as a multi-patient, is that all of us have been laid off from a job at one point or another. And I'm thinking that there is something fundamental that changes the individual's idea of what work means once they're laid off. And so when I probed and asked all these multi-patients, you know, have you been laid off and how that transformed them, many of them are very disappointed to even devastated in some points that they were let go. And I think, although none of them said it explicitly, it really made them take note of the fact that they should not put their career eggs all in one basket, if that makes sense.
So there was a certain battle-scarred quality to all of them. And in a sense, there was an economic imperative. How much of it was also about, for lack of a better term, a sense of personal self-worth or whatever? Because we know, we've done shows, I've had a lot of conversations with people who have experienced job loss. And obviously, there is the loss of the paycheck, but there is also that damage to one's sense of his or her own sense of worth or the arc of one's life, particularly since a lot of these folks, it sounds like, had known nothing or relatively little but success up until the point that they run into a wall that to some degree is beyond their control.
Right.
Control is another issue that comes into this too.
Right. So I think maybe, and I didn't explicitly ask this, but I know how I feel about it, in that multi-patientism might be an answer to insulating themselves from that from some extent. So, for example, if somebody has 5 jobs and one of them gets let go for some reason, they still have 4 other things to fall back on. Whereas one of the attorneys in the book talked about his friends who are partners in major law firms, they have one thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have $300,000 in income a year. And if that job goes away, they are devastated financially and other ways. So this is kind of an insurance policy, if you will, for people who have had that sense of having a job let go, and then how that played into their fundamental philosophy on work.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about work and career. The springboard is a new book called Multipassionals, The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio. My guest is Aaron Albert, who's an entrepreneur, writer, pharmacist, attorney, and professor. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So I want to ask, and I'm thinking more in terms of the mindset. We talked about the people who succeed, or at least their motivation. But, you know, there are a lot of people who lose jobs and their response instead is to just go out and find another job, or, you know, or if they're not fortunate, not find another job. I'm trying to get at what creates the successful multipassional, what skill set, what temperament, what qualities of humanity kind of create the person who succeeds at being a multipassional.
Yeah, so I think the successful multipassionals are those that, again, step back and looked at what they valued. You know, what did they want out of both their careers as well as their lives? And then kind of making an inventory or a list of what was important to them in terms of their values. And then using that as kind of the determining factor for, should I add on another facet of career, a gig, a project, etc. Another really interesting trend that a lot of the folks in the book talked about was that most of them never really applied for a traditional job. They were kind of brought to them by the universe based upon what previous work they were doing.
Gotten a tweet from a listener named Shannon who says, one joy of being in charge of your own career is being able to say no to assignments for time or ethical reasons.
Yeah, I love that. N and O are next to each other in the alphabet for a reason, as one of my friends loves to say. And the multipassional is good at saying no, too, usually. There's one in the book that she was still working on that. She was constantly saying yes and then figuring out retrospectively how to make it work with the rest of the things she was doing. But that was a lesson that she had been working on.
So is that one of the qualities of the people who fail at being multipassional, is that they don't say no often enough, that they try to stack too much on, or...
I don't know if there's enough data yet to determine whether or not people are not successful at multipassionalism, because it seems to be a newer thing.
I'm not saying everyone. I guess
yeah.
What I'm saying is, you know, no one, it's like any job or career path. No career path has 100% success rate for
right.
People who enter it. Multipassionals, I assume, would have the same thing, that there are certain people who are just not cut out for it.
Right. You know, people that can't manage their time very efficiently, they would be doomed, I think, as a multipassional, because all the multipassionals I talked to were very cognizant of their time. And being able to juggle several balls and be, I don't want to say multitask, but be able to see if another opportunity that's coming along fits into what they're doing. I think successful multipassionals do know their limits, but will make room and take cues from the universe as to whether or not something should be added on or deleted.
And what criteria, since you're the multipassional, you probably know the best, what's your criteria for saying no to something, to a new opportunity?
Oh, boy, that's a tough thing. I always go back to my values, things like honesty and integrity, working very creatively on new innovative projects and solutions. So I ask myself, does this project fit those criteria? If it does not, then I kindly say no. If it does, I figure out next, okay, how is this going to fit into everything else that I'm doing, and go from there.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about Multipassionals. It's a new book about the changing world of work and how to create your best career portfolio. My guest is the author, Aaron Albert. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about work and career. We're talking about a new book, Multipassionals, The Changing World of Work and How to Create Your Best Career Portfolio. Multipassionals are people who are working at sort of several career tracks simultaneously, although definition probably could be stretched so that it's about overlapping careers, too, that because it sounds like some drop off and all of that. Our guest is the author, Aaron Albert, who's an entrepreneur, pharmacist, attorney, and professor at Butler University. Well, beforehand, we were talking about the people who succeed and fail. We got a call a little while ago from a listener named Roberta who said she was a multipassional before there was a term for it. She's retired now. I guess my question is, we see this as accelerating from, you know, the government labor statistics. Is it more of a generational thing? I mean, are you more likely to be a multipassional now the younger you are?
That's a really interesting question, and I think it would go back to looking at what each generation values. So I know millennials and my generation, Generation X, we really, and the older I get, actually, the more I appreciate flexibility. And so flexibility in many ways becomes almost a form of capital mm-hmm. when it comes to your career development in that. And we talked about this earlier in the show, that some individuals actually value or will be willing to trade flexibility for financial capital when it comes to a job. So if that means, for example, I have to take a $10,000 pay cut to work from home, mm-hmm. Some people in some generations would be willing to do that.
So in terms of how this has evolved, you know, we've talked about the people who kind of succeed and the people who kind of who falter at it, and we've talked about the organizational skills that they need, time management skills, and all of that. What are the temperamental qualities? I mean, there seems to be, I've been fortunate in my life and career to know some truly innovative entrepreneurs, and I say this not to disparage them, that really, they're no smarter than the rest of us. But the difference that at least I saw in them was that they could live with a far higher degree of risk and feel comfortable about that than most people could. That they could, you know, really invest themselves completely in an outcome that was not foreordained and then sleep peacefully at night, whereas the rest of us would be tossing and turning all night long. So what are sort of the personal characteristics, aside from the intellectual ones, that drive a successful multipassional?
Well, I'd love to go back to risk there for a second, because I think many of the multipassionals in the book, as well as myself, I argue that being multipassional is actually safer mm-hmm. than having just one traditional day job, for the reasons that we talked about earlier, putting all your career eggs in one basket, being let go overnight, industries crashing and burning overnight. You know, the new safe, I think, is to have multiple things going on at the same time. Relative to kind of the personal traits, you know, one common theme I found among all the multipassionals is they were having fun with their careers. They didn't view it just as work. And even to the extent where some of them were using that as part of the algorithm and deciding or choosing whether or not they should add something or subtract it, is it fun? And if it's no longer fun, that's kind of one of the benchmarks that several of them use to let some career gigs, projects, etc. go.
How much of this is, because even in saying, you know, having several things is the new safe now, is there a sense that this is being driven, and it gets back to my earlier question about it, whether it's generational or not, one of my observations, and I do agree with you, I think that there is a changing mindset, is that to some degree that implied social contract has been broken, or at least its terms have been greatly revised. The old one was, okay, if you do all of the right things, you study hard, you do well in school, you do all of this sort of stuff, you're going to be taken care of and everything will be fine. But we're finding some of the safest professions in the country. I mean, you are a lawyer. You probably know the statistics of employment for law school graduates these days, that there are now law school graduates are turning around and suing their alma maters, in effect, for breach of promise because they can't find jobs and they're $200,000 in debt. How much of that is driven by the fact, the things that you have alluded to here, that that you really don't have a whole heck of a lot of faith that any institution is going to be there to be responsive to you and your needs?
One of the best quotes in the book about multipatients was from a physician friend of mine who was talking about his son studying different coursework. And the best quote he said to summarize what's going on right now is all bets are off. And this is coming from somebody that is a physician, right? You think that some careers are super stable, i.e. law being one of them, when in fact you are correct. You know, 40% of law school enrollment is down right now. Some law schools are making very tough decisions on closing their doors or merging. In pharmacy, we're kind of, I'm worried that pharmacy might be the next law school, in that when I graduated from pharmacy school, there were about 80 schools of pharmacy. Now there's over 130. And we're pumping out all these pharmacists, and pharmacy is a great career, great profession, great starting salary. But if we've got too many of them and the major markets, which are now saturated or saturating even more, I worry that, you know, students are putting all their eggs again in one basket. They're putting all their financial resources, their time, their energy into entering a quote unquote stable profession that may not be stable over time. So, you know, I think going back to that physician and talking about his son, he encouraged him to follow his passion, study things that he was interested in, because there is no more career-safe profession anymore. So if you're going to do something, you might as well do something that you truly love.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about multipatients, folks who have several jobs, several occupations at the same time. My guest is the author of a new book about multipatients with the title Multipatients, Aaron Albert. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, we've made a persuasive case for, you know, pursuing a multipatient path right now, but there are no unmixed blessings in life. What's the downside to being a multipatient?
Well, there's several, just like anything else. One of them is, you know, you need to take a step and look at your day job employer and what agreements you've signed with that employer. Can you moonlight? Can you do things on the side? You need to make sure that you can, or you're authorized to do as such. The second thing is you have to get really crazy about time. I mean, time is the one resource the multipatients agreed upon that you never get back. So you have to kind of go to your values, understand what's important to you, and then assess whether or not you have the extra time to focus on other projects, starting your own business, whatever the case may be. I think, you know, those two are kind of the big picture items that could be potential pitfalls or downsides. Some industries are much more friendly to allowing multipatientalism, i.e. academia. I mean, John, we were talking off the air. You're a multipational. I'm a multipational. We're both in academia. I think there are industries like academia that are a lot more user-friendly to the multipational movement. There are industries that are not so friendly to that as well. So you have to be cognizant of what, you know, industry you're in and whether or not they're going to let you do those things. So the other thing is just burnout, frankly. Some folks really say yes to too many things and end up burning out. So you have to be very cognizant and careful about taking on too much.
What about the old system, the sort of typical career path that you talked about, the 30 years, 9 to 5 and all of that? I mean, the downside, and I suppose this ties into your point about burnout, is that when 501 rolled around, you were off the clock. And the assumption was then that your time was your own. But to some degree, if you are a multipatient, you are the CEO of a one-person company. You never go off the clock, right?
That's true. And multipatients in the book mention that as soon as they get up in the morning to right before they go to bed at night, they're always on it. They're always working. But, I think there's a counter argument there in that traditional 9-to-5 day job is not 9-to-5 anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, employers hand you a cell phone or a BlackBerry or whatever, and they expect you to be on call 24/7 as well. So it's, do you want to be on call for yourself or do you want to be on call for your employer?
We are talking about multipatients here on No Limits. Doug, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to interject something very quickly. I'm a retired school teacher, but along with teaching, I was in the Indiana Army National Guard for over 20 years, and I also farmed. And I want to interject that a lot of people don't think of it this way, but the National Guard, the Reserves, are very much an additional job. And they call them part-time, but there many of them are full-time jobs, even when you're doing your job during the week. And I wanted to throw that in there because that's a career path also, and I am retired from it. So I just wanted to interject that, and I'll hang up here if you want to discuss it.
Thanks very much for the call, Doug.
Yeah, actually, one of the multipatients in the book was in the Reserves as well. So thank you for that comment, and that triggered my memory on that. Yes, it's great that you can add that on as a career as well, serve your country, and also go down a different career path that could lead you in different areas that you never may have even considered. In your case, Doug, being a teacher.
We've also gotten an email from a listener named Randy who wants to point out that actually the trend here goes back much further than perhaps it. He argues that, say, Thomas Edison, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson weren't called multipatient; they were called Renaissance men.
Yep.
That it was more about having a balanced set of skills. We also have a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. What if you are multipatient and it just gets to be way too much on your plate? How should I go about narrowing down to just one job?
Okay, the first point, I totally agree. Leonardo da Vinci, right? The Renaissance itself, that whole mindset has kind of been reinvigorated, I think. The too much stuff on your plate. I think, even people with traditional 9-to-5 day jobs, and I use 9-to-5 in air quotes there, get burnout as well. So you have to take a step back, I think, if you're getting to the point where you're burned out, and reassess, get a piece of paper, write down everything that you're doing, and have that candid conversation either with your boss or yourself, in the case of being a multipatient, that something has got to go. So what is it that's going to come off of your plate? And, what's that algorithm for you? What do you value? What are you great at? What will somebody pay you to do? And what do you love to do? And look at all of that. You can even rank out, your different jobs and discern, okay, well, this job out of the 5 jobs that I'm doing is number 5 on my list, so it really needs to come off.
We've also gotten a question via Facebook from a listener named Gary, and if you'd like to reach out to us by Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. In the interest of time, because we are getting close here, I'm going to pare down the question a little bit. The theme here really behind the question is, how should you go about having, like in your case, your anchor job, as it were, is at Butler University? If you are a multipatient and you're bringing really some other jobs to that anchor job, how should you structure the conversation with an employer or a potential employer about what your other responsibilities are?
Well, I think it's about the value add, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to talk to your employer about what it is that you can offer and what supplemental you'll bring to the table, be it in financial capital and or social capital, to that anchor job. There's been tons of studies about connectivity and social capital with employees. MIT's done a bunch of studies of IBM employees, and they found that those who had more connections outside of the corporation actually brought in a lot more value to the corporation itself than employees who just networked inside the corporation. So never discount the fact that if you're building your social capital in your network, that there's not value associated with that and that would be valuable to your employer, when in fact it is. I mean, we're all on Facebook, Twitter. Social capital is really important in this day and age, and it's super important to your employers in order to get customers, to get, in our case, you know, new students or future students to our universities. So there's value in that, and having that conversation of here's the extra value that I'm going to bring as a candidate to this position, I think is a win-win.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one more listener question. This comes from Michelle via email. It says, to what extent has the influx of white-collar professionals through the immigration program affected the ability of American college graduates to gain employment?
Well, I think it depends kind of on the profession itself. We've already talked about law and the fact that, you know, legal employment is grossly down post-economic downturn. And, you know, pharmacy, there's so many pharmacists now. I think that's a challenge as well. So it kind of depends
on... Thank God journalism hasn't been affected by that.
Yeah, it's a challenge to look at which industry and kind of what trends are happening. And then, you know, if you need to reinvent yourself, to stay relevant, to add on education, add on another gig, go in a different direction with your career.
So, and I guess I'd like to ask, where is the, as sort of a summing up thing here, what is the future of this? I mean, do you see more sort of multipational? In some ways, you could also argue that it's a you know, a fragmentation of career paths, so that you put things together in pieces and blocks more than in one solid thing. It's mosaic. Your career becomes a mosaic rather than a, you know, I can't think of a proper image there. But
it comes down to, do you want to be a technical expert and go 10,000 feet deep in one subject matter? Or do you want to be a generalist? Do you want to have your toes in several different waters? Do you want to know a little bit about a lot? And if you're the latter case, multipassionalism is definitely for you.
And that probably should be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Aaron Albert. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise. Thank you.
We will be back on Thursday. We're going to be talking about bringing food into some troubled neighborhoods. Our guest is going to be returning again, Troy Riggs, Director of Public Safety here in Indianapolis. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.